Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is Armin Navabi. Armin, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay, yeah, I'm going to rely on you completely because this is going to be one of those educational things for me. I know a little bit about it, but I think that you're more in touch with this topic. This is another thing that we're doing on Iran. There is a lot going on in Iran. You're probably not reading about it because it's just not that as prominent as it really should be. But there's some major, major seismic changes happening just geopolitically in that region, and especially what's happening with Iran. So they have the elections coming up in June, right? And Armin will go into detail about that. And right now, there is an effort, a sort of mild effort on the part of the U.S. and the European nations that were involved in the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, that was negotiated by the Obama administration, where that Trump essentially violated and pulled out of. And they want to try and revive it and see what can happen. Now, the question is there a point to doing it? Is it possible? Is it feasible? Has there been too much damage? Is it not going to happen? And how is this playing into what's happening with the election? Because the way that the election is happening, it's looking like, it's looking like an upward climb, right? Just a challenge to do this. So Armin, let's start with some background. Like, what's going on? The Iran nuclear deal, what's the status? Who wants to revive it? Is it going to happen? And how does the election play into it and everything else that's happening?
Right. So the expectation was that the Biden administration is going to, when he comes back in power, he's just going to like come in right away, get back to the deal and everything. Didn't really play out that way. And there's a lot of discussions about why is it not happening as fast as a lot of people, including the people in Iran, assumed it would. And it's very interesting because there's politics happening within both U.S. and within Iran, and also the Biden administration, as much as they criticized Trump's maximum pressure policy on Iran, they actually want to take advantage of it, right? They don't want it to go to waste, right? And there's different interests both within the United States and within Iran. I think Iran's government, I think a lot of people kind of assume that this is a Iran versus U.S. kind of thing, but it's more complicated than that. It's more people in the United States and Iran who want the deal to happen versus people in the United States and within Iran government who don't want the deal to happen. Right. So that's, I think, a better way of looking at it. And also people within Iran's government who pretend that they don't want the deal to happen, but they actually do want the deal to happen.
Yeah, well, that's classic. But so let's talk about it. Can you give us like ballpark percentages? So you're saying that the two sides are the people in Iran and the U.S. who don't want the deal to happen versus the people in Iran and the U.S. who want it to happen. And what is,
It doesn't matter what the percentages are. It matters who's in power, right? It matters who has the control. In Iran, like a lot of people think like, oh, there's elections happening and right now the reformists are in power and the reformists are going to lose this. It seems like they're going to be losing this election and we have only 1 month left until the election. And right now the negotiation is happening in Vienna, indirectly between United States and Iran, with Europeans being the middleman. And they think like, oh my God, we only have 1 more month to the election. And it seems like any day now, by the way, by the time the audio version of this might come out, things are like the deal is moving back and forth like very quickly, like every day things are changing, and by next week we might have a deal, we might not have a deal, we don't know, right? But things are people like want to escalate this thing because, you know, Rouhani only has one more month in office, and they're like, okay, we need to get this done before the hardliners come into power, and then we lose all opportunity because the hardliners will be against the deal. It's really not that simple. The idea of the reformists, you have to deal with the reformists, and that's the only chance you have to have a nuclear deal, is completely dismissing the fact that the reformists are not in power. At the end of the day, if Khamenei doesn't want the deal, if he's not happy with how things are going, the deal will not happen, whether the reformists are in power or not. And if he's happy with the deal, he will give it, like, behind the scene, he will give it a green light. In public, he will save face and he will act like he's, like, taking a tough stance, but behind the scene, he will give it a green light, whether the reformists are in power or the hardliners are in power. I mean, when we say in power, like, it's a show. They're not really in power. At the end of the day, Khamenei is like making the decisions. So yeah, basically this transition of power between from the reformers to the hardliners in the upcoming elections is just a facade. Like, it's a joke. It's not real. The decisions are being made by Khamenei. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question before you go on? Because we're going to go into that, like what's happening to the election and the sole candidate that's pretty much expected to win. But it's supposing, and this is what I mean about, like, you're right. Like, it's the people who are in power. It's not the people running. But if you're running for election for president in Iran and you want to get more votes, what position do you take? We're going to revive the deal or we're not going to revive the deal? Or do you just not talk about it?
Right. So, okay, depends on who your audience is, right?
You want to get more votes. You want to win the election. So what do you say? What position do you take?
The elections have been engineered. You don't really... Okay, so here's the thing. The people... If we want to... This is such a simplistic version of it, so I'm just take that but like 5 or 6 grain of salt. But if we categorize the people between the people who want to end the regime, the people who want reform, and the people who love the regime, right? The people who love the regime, they're against negotiations with the United States. They're like, we don't need them. We could survive this. The sanctions will make us tougher, blah, blah, blah. We will survive this. And the leaders of this group of people will signal to them like, yeah, screw the deal. But at the same time, they kind of know that with the sanctions, they don't even have room to breathe. So they will signal to the audience that we don't like screw the deal. We're going to make sure that the deal doesn't happen as much as we can. Or if it does happen, it has to be on our terms. But behind the scenes, they're trying to find a way for the deal to go through. Like they're taking a tough stance, but maybe not in reality, right? The people who are reformist, they are the least relevant people right now. They have the least number of followers right now. People who used to be reformists have given up on reformists, and they're now against the entire regime as a whole. These are the people who are still saying that, oh, look, the deal was good. It was supposed to bring prosperity to Iran. It was Trump's fault that all of this happened. And the people, a lot of people who are not with the regime, and they're like, no, the reform was just a joke. Reform was like a false hope. You guys are all the same. You use the idea of reform just to give a signal to us that maybe that we have a chance, but we don't have a chance. And every time things fall apart, you just want to blame it on Americans. We want to blame it on Trump. You want to blame it on this and that. They say like our enemies are in Iran. They're not in America. So those are the reformists are the least relevant movement right now, right? And then the other group of people are the people who are against the regime as a whole. These are the people who are saying like, why do we need nuclear power? Why, like, look at how much, like, was it worth all this? Like, was this, look how isolated we've become. Like, what would have, like, we have oil, we have gas. I mean, okay, fine, maybe some energy would have been great, but was it worth all of this? Like, you guys are just so stubborn that you keep pushing for something that has made us like this is, they say this is not about nuclear energy. This is about you guys sticking it to the, you know, to the all the, to having to all these other regimes so that you don't have to have a relationship with them, so you could build enemies of for your country, so you have an excuse to you know, create a movement based on having foreign enemies. And so people are like, this is like not for the whole nuclear energy thing is not for the people. Nothing has ever been for the people. And this has not, all of these negotiations and all of this stubbornness to have nuclear energy has brought nothing but misery. The cost, like they say, even if we ever get nuclear energy one day, whatever economic benefits that brings to us is going to be like nothing in comparison to all the hardship and all the missed opportunities of trade and prosperity that Iran have lost because of it in so many years. So they're like, this is all like a joke, right? So that's what they think, right? But I do want to focus on what's happening in Vienna, unless you have any questions about this before I'm going to go to that one, right?
No, now. That's good. This is good. Go on.
So by the way, just take into account that whatever we're saying right now about in Vienna could just like right after we end this might like, based on what the time that this is, we publish this, like things are changing as we speak in Vienna, right? So you could like maybe while you're listening to this, you have more hindsight and you could actually compare what we're saying and what actually ended up happening, right? Things are moving very, very fast right now, right? So,
so explain what's happening in Vienna.
Okay, so here's the thing. We're getting a lot of contradictory reports from what's happening there. The Russians and many other people and the Europeans are telling us things are going fantastic. Like, things are moving forward. And the Iranian Rouhani's administrations and his people, including Zarif and Araghchi and everybody else, comes in and they're like, oh yeah, things are moving forward. Everything is moving to the right direction. But it keeps hitting to a wall every time. And some people are saying, okay, no, we're almost there. The deal is almost back. But there are certain things that we who don't know what's happening behind the scene, we're waiting to see how is it possible for things, like we've been told like, okay, the deal is about to happen, okay? But there are a couple of issues with the deal happening that are the red lines for both Iran's higher ups, and by higher ups, I mean above the president, and also the Biden administration. There are a couple of red lines that, and also Biden administration red lines are being introduced to him by Congress as well. It's not just him, right? And it would be if it's true that the deal is actually moving forward and it's making a lot of progress and it's going to happen any day now, I would want to see that if that's true, how did we manage to pass these red lines, okay? And I could talk about these red lines. Before I talk about these red lines that both sides doesn't seem to want to budge, I do want to mention that let's go back a little bit in history, right? So there were some issues with how Obama did the deal and Trump's policy on maximum pressure at the same time, right? So the issue with Obama's original deal in 2015 was that it left a lot of things untouched. It had a sunset clause. It didn't touch Iran's, empire building and meddling in the region, Iran's missiles, Iran's human rights record. All of that was ignored. And also even the nuclear deal itself had a sunset clause, which basically, I know at the time, it was really, it was basically impossible to get anything more out of the deal. So you could be sympathetic to Obama's administration for not covering those things. But however, I don't know, you could be sympathetic or you could not be sympathetic. However, those were the flaws of Obama's deal, right? Those were some huge gaps in the deal, right? And the hope was that maybe that this would be a starting point for further deals with Iran, right? This would be like something that to get started, and maybe those other things could be covered later in other, once you build the, this will be a starting point where you, Iran could then signal that it's now going to build a better relationship with the rest of the world and then use this as a a starting point to also move further in other things. However, after Obama's deal, we saw that so if you look at Iran's government, you can't just look at it as this unanimous decision-making thing. Even though decisions are mostly made by Khamenei and he has to give the green light, that doesn't mean there is zero internal struggle or internal politics. Within, you know, Khamenei has the final say in things, but people still try to, there is some wiggle room, you know, like if Khamenei, like, tightens the grip too much, that would be risky for him, for his own survival. There is still power play, right? And there are people with different agendas that still try to do things that maybe Khamenei doesn't like, and sometimes they're actually successful at it, right? So what I was saying is that Obama's administration was mostly talking to Rouhani's administration, which is the presidency, and getting a lot of like positive. It seemed like everything was going fantastic. Zarif has a good relationship with Kerry. Rouhani's administration seemed to be like very welcoming and things, and they promised like, oh, all of these investments and everything is going to come to Iran. And this is a new phase. This is a new direction. Everything is hunky-dory after this. However, you have to understand that Rouhani's administration is not in control of what the IRGC does in Iran, right? The IRGC, and now, like, for many years, we told people that IRGC has more of a say in what Iran's foreign policy is like, more than Iran's foreign ministry or Iran's president as a whole. And we said that for so many years, and you know, people didn't believe this a little bit, or didn't believe it that much. They still saw Zarif and Rouhani as the face of Iran's foreign decision making process, and we told them like it's not really them. But just recently, we saw some audio leaks by Zarif that basically confirmed everything we were saying for the past couple of years, like without reasonable doubt. But the thing is, so what? Let me get to this.
Okay.
Let me finish this for you, because Obama was trying to see that they could maybe, like, with this nuclear deal, we could get some signals from Iran to show that now they're moving in a positive direction. However, it didn't work like that, because IRGC not only didn't stop them from becoming less aggressive in the region, they became more progressive, even more aggressive in the region. Not only they became progressive and more aggressive in the region, it is said that a lot of the money made from, you know, Obama's deal was actually directly used in becoming more aggressive in the region, right? So it didn't really work out the way a lot of people were hoping, right? However, when Trump came into power, and now he had his own, okay, so this is not working. Iran's behavior is not changing in the region. This deal is not working out for us. Let's do maximum pressure on Iran, right? That also didn't work, right? So the maximum pressure policy by Trump was also Iran's, like IRGC, continued to become more and more aggressive in the regions, right? So, in fact, it escalated even more. So Trump was like, oh, Obama didn't change Iran's behavior. I'm going to do maximum pressure. Okay, well, yours didn't work either, right? So Biden's administration philosophy is like, okay, so here's what we fix. Okay, it seems like this is their philosophy, okay? Obama didn't go far enough. Trump's maximum pressure was too aggressive. How about we do both, right? How about we take advantage of, like, keep the maximum pressure of what Trump, like, don't, like, keep our foot on the neck, and maybe, you know, don't remove the pressure, but still dangle Obama's carrot in front of them as well, right? So maybe the combination of maintaining Trump's maximum pressure while also offering Obama something like what Obama did 2015 deal. Like, the problem is, like, people are like, okay, go back to the deal. And maybe Biden's administration is like, well, not quite back like the deal. And that is like, what? So we could go into more details on that. But do you have any questions? You want to say something?
Yeah, no, I was going to ask you something, and it totally slipped my mind now. But maybe that's because you already answered it at some point. But yeah, go ahead.
Right. So So now, why is it not quite like the thing, right? Not quite like what Obama, going back exactly like it was, because both sides want more. Both sides like so. Khamenei seems to came out and said, you know what? We're not going to go back to the deal until all sanctions are removed, all of them, every single one of them, not just the one that are for nuclear, every single one of them. And even after they're removed, then we're going to go through a period of seeing if they actually are really removed, are they symbolically removed, or are they practically have been removed, right? And then we will go back to the deal, right? So Khamenei is like, you guys cannot be trusted. We already did a deal with you, and you backed out of it. So now you guys go ahead first. You guys remove the sanctions, and then even after you remove the sanctions, we're still not going to go back. Then we have to analyze if we see what's the effect, right? Because here's the problem: you could still there are still some things that Iran wouldn't have access to even without removing the sanctions. Even with removing the sanctions, there are still some financial barriers for private or institutions to be able to do deal with Iranian companies, right? Or do so even if symbolically the sanctions are removed, all of that investment that was promised to Iran might actually not work out the way. So that's why Khamenei is saying, you remove all the sanctions, we look at it, if we see if it's actually having an effect, and then maybe we will come back to the JCPOA or whatever, right? So Khamenei was asking for more than just before, and he's saying you guys do the first step, and the sanctions that are removed should be not just the sanctions that Trump introduced, it should be all the goddamn sanctions, every single one of them, every single one of them, right? And Biden was like, no, we're not going to make the first move, you're going to make the first move, right? And it also seemed to be suggesting that this, the our removal of sanctions is not just going to, like, it seems what the United States Congress wants, some people within Biden's administration and also the Congress are pressuring Biden to demand to ask from Iran not just compliance with the JCPOA, going back to the compliance with the JCPOA, but also two other things: to pressure Iran on its human rights record, and also to pressure Iran on its meddling in the region. So they're like, okay, not only we're not going to remove the sanctions, your compliance with the JCPOA might not even be good enough for us to remove the sanctions. We also want you to be, we also want these two other things. Basically, the things that Obama didn't do, right? And both sides are like, basically Iran's administration are like, what the hell are you guys asking for? You guys pull out of the deal, so you guys have to come back. And now, not only you're not coming back, you're asking for more before you come back? And Biden administration was like, yeah, that's right.
that's right. I just remember what I was going to ask you. Is the Iran nuclear deal, like the urgency of it and how important it was back when Obama and Kerry did it, is it as important right now, or have things changed? Like, how important is it to the U.S.?
Okay, so this is the thing. It depends on who you talk to within the United States. The Biden administration wants to just get this over with so that they can focus on China, right? But there are many Republicans and also some Democrats that are pressuring Biden, like, no, we need more from Iran before you could move out of this whole situation, right? So
What is giving them the courage to ask for more? And I just want to ask this because this is, to me, as someone who's not as in tune with this as you are, right? Mm-hmm. I just want to add, what happened during the Trump time or since he pulled out of the deal, right? Or actually violated the deal, didn't really pull out of it, but he violated it. But since then, you've had the Soleimani killing and Iran didn't really respond. You've had a couple other things where, they've been tested with pretty intensely, but in a way they kind of showed their cards, or they were put in positions by Trump to show their cards. And it turned out they don't really have as strong a hand as it may have seemed before. You know what I mean? So is it? Yes. So has that had an impact on the Biden people saying, okay, well, you know what? We thought that it was a really intense thing before. It's probably not that intense. We could probably go and ask for more and get this done that way.
Well, yeah, that's why Iran has tried to be acting tough and all by like saying that, oh, we're going to turn off the cameras that were supposed to be there. They turn off the, you know, and then they acted like very tough and they're like, okay, we give you 3 more months. And the 3 more months was just finished yesterday. And they're like, okay, we give you one more month.
that's what I'm saying. Like, how important,
They look very weak. They look very pathetically weak. And there's
so how urgent is the deal then? Like, I mean, wouldn't you go back and say, okay, well, these guys are weak. They're demonstrably weak. I mean, they had their biggest general, the national hero, killed, and they basically warned the people that, hey, listen, we're going to drop some bombs. We don't want to rock the boat too much. And if they're in that kind of position, then and they're extending these deadlines 1 more month, like, what is the deal really? Does it really have the kind of gravity and the urgency that it felt?
So Rouhani is trying to convince the Americans that it is important that it happens fast, right? The reason why maybe the Americans are not feeling the pressure is what you just said, right? But again, the deal might be happening any day now, right? But another reason is that the Americans are not paying that much attention to this, right? So there's not that much of a – there's so many other things that Americans are pushing Biden on. So that this is not something that the Biden administration is getting that much pressure on. Like, oh, why? Like, there's not that many Americans that are saying, why are you not going back to the deal? Why are you not going back to the deal? So they don't feel the pressure from the American citizen. Another thing is that the Biden administration has made it so that its branding is that foreign policy is going to put human rights front and center, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea of them not pushing Iran's administration on its human rights record if when they had the chance might be one reason. There are some, again, there's a conflict within Biden administration as well. There are some people even within Biden administration that think that pushing Iran on its human rights record is important when you have the chance. And also another thing that the fourth reason might be that Biden thinks that it's important to have do something like this with Congress, and the fact that he's getting the pressure from Congress, not just from his administration, but actually from Congress to ask for more. Right, and that might be another reason.
Well, there's another thing. What about the Israel factor? I mean, one of the big factors here was Netanyahu, right, and Israeli pressure to get this thing done before. Right. So, is that a factor anymore? How does Israel feel about it?
Has that changed too? Israel is expecting that this deal is going to happen at some point, right? So, and it's getting ready for that, right? Mm. So. It's hard to see what they're saying behind the scenes, but the expectation is that they are trying to push the Biden administration to maybe ask for more if the deal happens, rather than pushing for it for the deal happens, because the expectation is that this deal at some point is going to happen, so you might as well change the nature of the pressure. Right. But we do need to talk about what are the red lines that it's going to be. So, by the way, if you're listening to this, you might now know, because I don't know right now, because I'm from the past and you're listening to this in the future. So if the deal has happened now, I want you to take a look at how did they manage to get out of these things. Right. So I think the three major things, right? One of them is the one that I mentioned, right? The first red line is that Iran is like, don't you dare even bring up human rights and our meddling around the region. That was not part of the original agreement. And so that was the main thing. And they're like, no, we want to include this. And Iran's people from Iran's government are saying, no, you don't include this. So that's the main, that's the number one, right? The second thing is that who moves first, right? This is very interesting, because Khamenei wanted to here's the thing. It's very tough to be on the Iranian negotiating table compared to the Biden negotiating table, right? On Rouhani's negotiating table compared to Biden, right? Because the pressure that the Biden negotiating table is getting from Congress and other politicians in the U.S. is not like from it's not like a revelation from God himself that they have to abide by, right? So Congress can pressure Biden. There are some people on Biden's team can pressure Biden to make sure that they ask for more, right? But at the end of the day, Biden's administration has the option to be like, you know what? No, screw you guys. We're going to do this, right? But when it comes to Rouhani, the people who are sitting on the Rouhani's negotiating table, when Khamenei says, "You don't you dare do this," they can't go like, oh, Khamenei, screw you. Rouhani's administration cannot ignore the pressure that is coming from Khamenei. Everything Khamenei says becomes binding. It becomes like a revelation from God. And the only maneuver they could do around it is to somehow come up with an interpretation of it. It's kind of like trying to look at Quran verses and trying to make it seem like it means something else, right? So, for example, Khamenei said, we will not directly negotiate with Americans. And so basically Rouhani's team was like, oh my God, how do we do this? Like, this is like a complicated deal and we can't even talk to the Americans, right? So right now, if you look at what's happening in Vienna, there's two hotels just like very close to each other. And the Iranians are in one hotel and the Americans are in another hotel because of what Khamenei said. The Europeans have to go and talk to Iranians and they go to the other and then talk to Americans. Like, there cannot be, because of Khamenei's,
it's not direct.
No American can talk to any Iranian because of God himself has apparently have spoken, and you cannot talk directly to each other. They can't even have American flag in the hotel that the Europeans are talking to the Iranians. Zarif just recently canceled his trip to Vienna because of the hotel that they were supposed, because the Vienna had like Israeli flag up in response to what the attacks on Israel. So Israel, like, Zarif had to actually, everything is like minute by minute, people are counting everything that's happening every day. And one entire trip was canceled because of an Israeli flag was raised. Anyways, it's really stupid. But the main barrier that Khamenei just threw out in this whole negotiation on the Iranian team was that he announced that two things Khamenei said. He said, first of all, we're not going to make the first move. The Americans have to make the first move, right? So what Rouhani's negotiating team has to do is like, how can we, because the Biden team is also saying that we're not going to make the first move. You guys have to make the first move. So the natural reaction was like, oh, let's meet in the middle, right? So let's meet in the middle. Let's look. We take one step, you take one step. We take one step, you take one step, right? That would be the natural way to negotiate, to meet in the middle, right? However, the Biden administration can be flexible. The Biden administration could be like, we said this, but now we're going to negotiate. The Rouhani's negotiating team are like, we can't negotiate on that because God has spoken, right? It's not like he said it, but now we can maybe change it. There's no changing what Khamenei has said. So the only way that they could be flexible on that is to try to interpret his words for it to mean something else, which is really hard to do. Like, again, it's kind of like interpreting the core, like scripture from God in a way that makes it more flexible. Another thing that Khamenei said is that, yeah, we're not going to go back to the deal until all the sanctions have been removed. And so, like, so he wants sanctions, not the JCPOA sanctions, not Trump sanctions, every goddamn sanction to be removed. Even the sanctions that were there before that were introduced because of human rights record and stuff like that. Like, that was not even part. So, see, here's the thing. A lot of people are criticizing Biden, like, why are you not going to, like, people are like, oh my God, like people like Kyle Kunsky, why are you not going back to the deal? Why are you not going back to the deal? You should go back to the deal right away. You guys, United States came out of the deal, so you should go jump back right to the deal. You shouldn't be negotiating. You just should go back to the deal. Well, Khamenei is demanding that all the sanctions that weren't even part of the nuclear deal be removed, even the ones that are like had nothing to do with Trump, even the ones that were based on human rights records and stuff, right? So that is a very tough demand. That's a very like the Biden is like, what the hell? Like, we can't do that. These are so. In fact, even if they wanted to do that, they are so complicated. Their removal of those things are not even in. You know, when it comes to the sanctions that Trump introduced, Biden could remove those with just an executive order immediately today, right? But when it comes to all the other sanctions that Khamenei was removed, those were not executive decisions that like he could just remove. Those are more complicated. So it would be so time consuming to even remove those ones. So yeah. So basically, Khamenei is on purpose making it very difficult. Unless here's the thing, and I'm not joking about this. The only way that you could become more flexible is to try to reinterpret what Khamenei means by all, right? So this is how complicated it becomes when your leader on your side is supposed to be like his words are supposed to be like the final say and as solid as a revelation from God, right? Like, so it makes it very difficult. So if you look at what the sanctions have been categorized, the current sanctions on Iran have been put into three categories: green sanctions, yellow sanctions, and the red sanctions. So this is the third way of us discussing what is a red line that United States it does not want to pass, and but Khamenei is demanding for them to like, yeah, you have to remove these ones, right? So the green sanctions that the Biden administration has signaled that they're very much ready to remove are the sanctions on oil and gas, shipbuilding, car building, metal, and, you know, wood and stuff like that, right? Those are like, guys, those are green. We could remove these, right? Like, they're like shown willingness to remove them, right? The one that seems to be a tougher thing, but maybe they would be willing to remove, is the sanctions on Iran's central bank, right? Iran's central bank right now is under sanction, and that has made financial deals with all countries in Iran very, very difficult. So that's the yellow category. But that potentially could be removed. The red sanctions are the ones that right now United States are like, no, we're not removing these. And how many people on Iran side are like, you got to remove these, right? And these are, again, had nothing to do with the JCPOA. These are independent from those. But Khamenei is demanding that they also be removed. And these are the sanctions on the IRGC. These are the red sanctions. The sanctions on IRGC and the sanctions on the members of the people that are directly connected to Khamenei, right? And Khamenei wants these removed, and that's his red line, right? The thing is that if they don't remove the sanctions on IRGC, the IRGC is the military arm in Iran that has economic connections to a lot of things in Iran, right? So if Biden administration does not remove those sanctions, a lot of private, even if the United States comes and says like, guys, sanctions has been removed, we're back to the JCPOA deal, Obama's deal, great. But the sanctions on IRGC are still there because IRGC is supposed to be like it's a terrorist organization, obviously, right? And that designation is going to remain there. So they're going to be under sanctions. The thing is that if you had a private organization, there's the science of how the understanding of which organizations in Iran are directly tied to IRGC or not is really hard to figure that out, right? These IRGC does deals under the table. It's not really easy to understand which organization in Iran is tied to IRGC, which one it isn't. So it's really unsafe. Like, this is an organization that is under sanction, and your private organization, if it does deals with an Iranian organization, you might get tainted by just doing deals in Iran without you knowing it, and now you are a private company that has been doing deal with a terrorist organization, and like, oopsies, now you're also on the blacklist, right? So even if you get removed the sanctions, a lot of giant organizations around the world might not want to still do deals with Iran because of the fact that the IRGC is still under sanctions, right? They don't want to get associated with that. So that's a problem. So again, the things that you have to work, if the deal goes through, if you're listening to this later and the deal has gone through, you look at what happened. Did the IRGC, the sanctions on IRGC and Khamenei's council were removed? Did they manage to find a way to reinterpret Khamenei's words so that Iranians can move side by side with Americans, or the Americans that agree, okay, we move first? And also, what happened to going easy on human rights record and meddling in the region? Did the Biden administration become more lenient on that? Or is it the Iranian negotiators that became more lenient on that? So these are the three things that both sides' red lines, and it seems like they're not even close with each other. So the fact that they're claiming to us that they're making a lot of progress, I want to know how are these things are being dealt with right now.
Right. So, okay. So looks at this. You've talked about some of the short-term, intermediate-term things. There's one more short-term aspect, and you've touched on it a little bit with the elections, right? So what's going on? Do you want to get a little bit more into the elections and what's happening? Because you had that interesting theory about it. Do you want to talk about it?
We have to do a follow-up on the election, so we could talk about that. That might not be very relevant. The only thing that is relevant about the elections right now is that the whole show of, hey, reformist versus hardliner, this election, they have moved. They're not even pretending that anymore. Unless something dramatic happens, and one of the... Okay, so basically, what happened, I think, yesterday or the day before yesterday, I forgot which day it was. No, I think it was yesterday. Yeah, this just happened, is that the Guardian Council in Iran came and with the list of there were around more than 500 people applied to become candidates in the upcoming Iranian elections, more than 500 of them. And guess how many, do you know, Ali, how many of them were approved?
Well, there's one that's running.
No. Approved for running. What do you mean one? How could you have
for running? Okay, no. I thought you were talking about who ended up. No, I don't.
Seven. Seven out of 500 were approved to run. And the issue is that the people who were rejected, nobody saw it coming, right? Some of the most powerful people in Iran, even people who were close to Khamenei, were rejected to become even a candidate. And almost any serious competitor to Reisi was also eliminated. Like Larijani was, like the major shock was not the fact that Larijani was not approved to be a candidate. So right now it seemed like Reisi was approved and six other jokers that don't seem to have a chance unless something crazy happens, just like Rouhani didn't have a chance unless something crazy happened and he became elected.
Reisi to win.
They want Reisi to win, right? They have, like, even the people who were, like, even a little bit had a chance against him, they even removed them, right? And basically, the only one reformist candidate, nobody even know who he is. And he's not even, it's a joke. It's so bad that Reisi himself complained that this is not competitive. Reisi himself is like, you're just gifting me the presidency and nobody's going to take my presidency seriously if it's just gifted to me like this, right? Like, I mean, it was always a joke. It was always a fake election, but it has never been this transparently a joke made up election, right? Even the hardliners are complaining that nobody's going to come and show up to vote if this is like, if you just like, why even have an election, right? Like many, every year people always say like, this is all always rigged. Why even have an election? But the difference is, since yesterday, the difference is that even the hardliners, the pro-regime hardliners are now saying, why even have an election? Even Reisi is saying, I don't have a competitor this is like giving me a ball with an empty, you know, goal for me to, you know, with no defenders for me to score. And even the people who used to be, this is, okay, the brother of Ali Larijani, which is Sadiq Larijani, he is, used to be the member of the Guardian Council, and he is saying that this is a joke. Even the former members of the Guardian Council are saying this is a joke. And they're saying that this year, the pressure by security forces, and when they say security forces, they're talking about IRGC. They're saying the pressure of the security forces on the Guardian Council has been so incredible that basically everything has been shown, everything has been selected. Like, you know how I said Khamenei makes all the decisions, but even though he makes the decisions, he has to still maneuver politically against people who are against his interests, and he doesn't, even though he seems to be the king, things that he wants doesn't go through always the way he wants it, right? He is tightening his grip even more than before. Like, he is removing all sources, even sources of pretend. Here's the reason, Ali, because the way the elections in Iran work, they always try to make it seem like the people have a choice. But this this show that is a fake show, right, sometimes comes and bites them in, you know, in a way that they didn't anticipate, right? So, for example, in the last elections, they didn't necessarily want Rouhani to win. They just wanted to have, you know, maybe Raisi win. But all of a sudden, Rouhani became so popular and he won, right? And maybe, we don't know. But we know that the head of the Guardian Council himself has come and said that in the previous elections, when Mousavi became a serious competitor to Ahmadinejad and all the street protests happened, and with Khatami winning, Jannati, who's the head of the Guardian Council, he himself has said, we made mistakes. So they're basically openly saying that we should basically forget giving people false hope. We're now going to not just control people and act like we're democracy. We're going to be transparent about it. We're going to become full dictatorship. This is a Shia Islamic state. Like, it's the whole republic part of the Islamic Republic. They're becoming more open about how, I mean, Khamenei just a couple of years ago suggested that maybe they should get rid of the presidency. He suggested that at some point we need to get rid of the presidency. And this seems to be an in-between move from here to there, where they just make the presidency, like, not even give it a chance to for reformers or somebody that they didn't predict to come into power.
What do you replace it with, the presidency?
A prime minister, which is completely chosen by Khamenei himself, going to a prime minister back, you know, to how it was.
Yeah.
Having completely a prime minister. Yeah. Basically becoming somebody that is chosen by the upper ups, the people don't have a say, and it just becomes like the management side of Khamenei's. Like, it's like people are saying it's effectively like that right now. You might as well just like remove all, you know. The thing is that this whole, when it comes to the Islamic Republic, the Republic, a part of the Islamic Republic, was forced on the current regime by the communist elements that were against the monarch, right? So the idea, like this whole idea of wanting freedom and wanting for people to have a say, that's not what the mullahs ever had in mind. This is why the mullahs traditionally were on the side of the monarchs against the leftists, right? But eventually when the Shah became unpopular, the mullahs and the leftists became united. And then when they managed to get rid of the monarchy, they were like, okay, so let's, you know, people were demanding freedom and secularism, freedom and, you know, democracy. And so it was really hard. That was the foundation of their revolution. So it was really hard to just give them an Islamic government. They had to give them an Islamic Republic, which is basically the part, the leftists use the management and the authority of the mullahs to bring back down the Pahlavi dynasty. But when the mullahs came into power, they managed to get rid of all the communists and the leftists and mass execute them, which Raisi, who is now going to be the president, maybe, was a major part of carrying out that the executions. So that's going to be highlighted a lot if he becomes the president, that his history of executing all these leftists and all the commies is a major part of his history, which is going to be, you know. So they came into power, they got rid of all these communists, they executed them, but at the same time, they couldn't deny the republic part. They didn't want to. They didn't believe in democracy, but it was part of the foundation of the revolution. So it basically got stuck in, right? Now they're trying to slowly get rid of the republic part of the Islamic Republic and just becoming a fully Islamic state, in not just in practice, which is already like that, but also transparently.
Yeah, so that's... Okay, so we've got about 10 minutes left, so we should take some of the... There are a couple of patron questions that we're going to take, but what does a Raisi presidency look like? So he gets elected. What does it look like, and how is it going to be different from the past? Like, it's orchestrated.
It's orchestrated, but again, just because it's orchestrated, that doesn't mean that it always ends up happening the way that... I mean, like, it did seem like originally Raisi wasn't supposed to come in. It seemed like they were trying to signal to the IRGC that they're going to have a seat in power, but that didn't work out. And it does... So the thing is that Raisi's presidency is also a lot about who's going to succeed Khamenei as the supreme leader. That's a whole other conversation that we could do another stream about the elections. I mean, within 1 month, we're going to know if Raisi wins or not for sure. But again, it's hard to imagine how Raisi is not going to win if things don't change, right? Like, it's serious. Like, he seriously doesn't have a competitor. Like, it's even Raisi's followers are like, you're making this too obvious. Raisi's number one fans and Raisi himself are like, why do we even have an election? Like, it's so... he's so comfortably gonna win given the current situation that maybe even his fans are not gonna go vote, because they're like, well, he's gonna win anyways. Like, who is he gonna who's his competitor, right? Again, nothing's for sure, because we said the same thing. Like, Rouhani wasn't supposed to have a chance until he all of a sudden said some crazy things and people were like, oh, okay, maybe him, right? So maybe one of this pretend reformists right now last minute comes and says something crazy. The thing is that even if that happens, people have fell for that so many times that it's hard to imagine that people are actually going to come and vote for a reformist this time, because they think it's just a false way of giving people hope. Here's the thing. I'm not going to mention the disease that is going right now, because YouTube might not like it. But one thing that might be part of the calculation of Islamic Republic right now is that there's going to be a very low turn up for the votes. And if so we usually throw a reformist to excite people so that they actually come out and vote, because we need the high turnout numbers to a signal to the world the legitimacy of the government to the world. But if we're going to have a low turnout, this is a good year to have it, because we could blame it on the fact that people are scared to come out because they might catch the disease and all, right? And like, this is a perfect time for that. We might as well do it right now.
The beer bug. Yeah. So, okay. So, you know, we've got around 7 minutes left. So let's just take any of those. I think at least 4 questions that I think we can take here. Okay. So let's take Susanna at 1103. Okay. Susanna saying, how will Iran's open support of Hamas, especially in the recent war, affect the deal?
You're right. So this basically the parts of the U.S. government that wanted to pressure Biden's administration to make human rights an important part of, and they're meddling in the Middle East, an important part of the negotiations, they were given a gift by this whole situation in Israel, because Hamas and also the Islamic Jihad group openly have said recently and even a couple of months before about the level of support that they get from Iran. And Iran doesn't hide that anymore anyways. So they're very transparent about that. Hamas is transparent about that. Iran's government is transparent about that. And the Islamic Jihad group is also transparent about that. So being Israel, being a U.S. ally, doing United States negotiating with Israel's, you know, most powerful enemy, and not making the Biden administration not pushing for making Iran's meddling in on providing support to Israel's enemies a condition would be, you know, unimaginable if that is not a major, you know, if Biden's administration is not being pressured for them to be like, yeah, you guys can't just attack our ally like this, and for us to basically come and remove all sanctions from you, like, no. So again, this is why it's so hard for me to imagine what do people mean when they say, like, it's any day now, the progress is, there's so much progress. Like, I want to really know how is so much progress is being made. If there's, if, you know, who's becoming more lenient on issues like this? Like, I can't imagine the Iran's administration being like, okay, we're going to stop supporting Hamas and Hezbollah. I can't imagine that being the case. So is it the Biden administration that is saying, like, okay, we'll remove all sanctions, even if you're going to support Hamas and Hezbollah? Or is it that maybe the Iran side is accepting that maybe you could keep the sanctions that are about IRGC, because we're going to reinterpret what Khamenei meant by all? So again, I don't know how the progress is being made. These are some really hard red lines on both sides, and I can't wait to see how they manage to maneuver around them. Right?
Yeah,
so we'll see.
1113 from Music Guy saying, if a deal is made, will Iran have to agree to limit China's influence?
I don't think there's already way too many things. No, I don't think the United States is like even has no. They don't. That would be a major overreach of telling Iran's government on not dealing with China. Like, obviously, people, like, I mean, China is part of this negotiation, but China, because like, China is part, one of the countries in the negotiation. China is going to be like, what? No, I don't think so.
But this, and how would you do that anyway? I mean, that China's influence, I mean, you can, it's a very, very broad thing. I mean, influences one country and the other. I mean, they're so complex and there's so many, like, yeah, shades of them. I don't think you can.
Yeah, China is part of the deal. Anyway. So I don't think, yeah. Anyway.
All right. So Susanna is saying, will Iran's escalating use of attack drones influence the deal? So their attack drones really took the U.S. by surprise, didn't they?
Yeah. And I think, like, right before the deals, Iran escalated everything to such a high level so that there's a lot more that they could give to use as negotiation. You know what I mean? So they thought, like, right before the deal, if we use more drones, if we meddle here, if we attack here, if we stop the cameras, if we increase their enriching the uraniums, then when we go to the negotiating table, then now we have so many chips to play with. Like, okay, you know, so that was their calculation, right? But I think Biden administration managed to be like, no, like, basically ignored all of that. So that didn't work out the way that they, basically they actually used it as a way to suggest that, you know, to suggest even more that Iran is out of compliance and to get Europeans on board with the Americans to demand more, not less, right?
So yeah, it's in a weak position. Like, this is the thing. I mean, we talked earlier about the whole Soleimani thing. The response to that was very weak. And then you've got the Abraham Accords, and you have all of these alliances between Israel and all these Arab countries and, right, and Muslim majority countries, like, that are sort of anti-Iran. That's the whole purpose of that, is to form a sort of axis against Iran. I mean, there's so many, I don't know. It seems like they do want to flex their muscle a little bit, but it's just not working. It seems to be backfiring. Shot down their own plane. You know, they're just the whole thing has been, they've just shown their cards in a way that I don't think they're ever going to have the kind of leverage they ever did before.
Yeah, we'll see.
It's a tough thing. Well, let's see. Yeah, let's see what they come up with.
Let's see. What they have on their side is the fact that Biden wants to get this over with. But again, Biden administration really wants to move past the Middle East, but the Middle East has a habit of dragging, you know, say the government back in somehow, right? Even if you want to focus on China, if you stop focusing on the Middle East, well, China is going to move into the Middle East even more. And if you want to focus on China, you don't have to go back to the Middle East. We'll see. Okay, here.
Okay, next question. Possibly off topic, but what is your reaction to Israel destroying Iran's attack drone factory 2 days ago? Do you know about this?
Yeah. It's so amazing that how we all we just know it's Israel, even if it's not announced. They're like, oh, drone factory destroyed. Thanks, Mossad, I guess, right? I think Israel's government is doing a good job at signaling to Iran that we don't have to wait for United States to do things to you if you step out of line. We could, like, Israel's government is signaling that we don't need, like, yeah, okay, even if you become, if you do, even if you do a deal, even if United States is putting more pressure on us compared to before about what we do in Palestine and everywhere else, just a reminder that we could take care of business ourselves. You still have to worry about us. You know, and nobody's gonna come back and tell us not to blow up Natanz or attack your facilities. I honestly kind of think that this is the best way. When it comes to Israel's policies, as much as I criticize them what they do in Palestine, these kind of operations in Iran, the one, you know, taking out Fakhrizadeh, blowing up Natanz, taking out this drone factory, these are the best ways to not, you know, to fight back against Iran's influence without much collateral damage. And without, these really hurt, and also without going to full out war. These are, I think, very effective. And this is something that Israel does that I support.
Right. Yeah, and even it exposes the weakness even more, right? Yeah. That's the thing. So, yeah, we've reached the end of this. We're over a little over an hour now. But I wanted to announce today that Susanna, yes, our friend Susanna, it is her first year anniversary of being the CEO of Atheist Republic. Atheist Republic was founded, you're listening to him right now, if you heard him talk like throughout this podcast, is Armin Navabi founded Atheist Republic today. It has, like, how many members you have around the world now? Like, it was 2.1, 2.4 million or something.
2.4, yeah.
2.4 million people. So the largest online platform for atheists around the world, in the world right now. Okay, and Susanna is right up top of it. She's a CEO, and she's just done a fantastic job. And today marks 1 year of it. So,
yeah.
And congratulations, Susanna. And, you know, we're just fortunate and privileged to have you leading this.
And this last 1 year for Atheist Republic, it has been the fastest growth rate for Atheist Republic when it comes to everything we do. And I don't think that was a coincidence. So, yeah.
Yeah, it clearly wasn't. So she's saying it's almost 2.5 million. So there you go. Ooh. Even more growth. It's fantastic.
She has eyes everywhere, by the way. I don't know.
She does have eyes. She's like a potato.
Okay.
She's not a potato.
Music guy is saying congrats, Susie. Mars is saying congratulations, Susie. I'm very thankful we met. Hope you've been doing well. Aww, yeah. That's so sweet. Look at this.
Yeah, you're anytime. And then
I do want to wait. Before I forget, guys, if you want, one thing we're doing, these are live streams that we do with our patrons only. And I know a lot of our patrons can't come, and because of the hours that we do this, cannot show up live. So one thing we're doing for our patrons is we're allowing them to send their questions ahead of time. So you could be a $1 patron. Just becoming a $1 patron means that every time we're doing a live stream, you get to send your questions to us ahead of time. And even if you're not live here, we'll make sure at the end of the show We read your questions, even if you don't get to come and watch the show live. So if you want to make sure that every topic we cover, we respond to the questions about the topic at the end of the show, link in the description, become a patron. And either show, you could also, as a patron, you could also show up live, just like the people who are here with us live today. But you either show up with us live and ask your questions live, or you could send us questions to us ahead of time, right? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think it's so
good that we're doing this for our patrons.
Right. And for the rest of you, like, if anybody's listening to this, like Armin mentioned several times, like a lot of you are going to be listening to this on audio. If you like what you hear, if this is something that you're interested in and you want to tune in, you can watch us do it. You can actually watch, right? And not just hear, but watch us on video. And we're not such bad looking guys, and we're okay to look at, right? That's good. Armin occasionally will take off his shirt and so on. So there's, I mean, there's, you can come and you can watch us, and you can participate. You can add your comments. You can talk to us live and just ask questions and everything. So
I didn't know how to respond to Ali's jokes. So I'm just
yeah. So I wasn't joking. So patreon.com/SJME. You go there. You can become a patron for as little as $1 a month, and you will get five, sometimes six episodes a month. This month, I think, you know, getting six. Yes. So and again, for like a very nominal cost. So please. Do check it out. Do consider it. If you're watching this on YouTube or you're listening to this on YouTube, hit the subscribe button.
By the way,
hit the bell to get notifications. Something.
You don't get coverage of the topics that we cover here the way that we cover them. I know
you don't
get it anywhere else. You don't get it anywhere. I've checked. Okay. Am I saying that my, coverage and Ali's questions and opinions on, you know, Pakistan or Iran or Palestine, Israel is better than all the shows on CNN, I don't know, MSNBC, Al Jazeera, everywhere else? Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I've checked. This level of nuance and this kind of coverage, you don't get it anywhere else. So if you want to encourage us to keep doing this, you can support us on the Patreon.
I'm not
joking, by the way. This is not me exaggerating.
No, I agree with you.
You don't get coverage like this anywhere else. Yeah.
Well, there is. I know that. So, for example, I'll also tell you why. Like Armin is connected to people in Iran. Like, he hears from people on the ground in Iran all the time. Like, he hears things that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily see on the news. I think you've even been, even people from CNN like Jake Tapper have even retweeted you before you got banned on Twitter. So I mean, it is absolutely true. I mean, you're not gonna, you know, better or worse, I don't know, but the thing is, you will get a perspective here that you're not gonna hear in most other places. And that's actually what we try to do on purpose. We try to talk about things that you're not gonna hear. So Armin works, music guy is saying Armin works for Mossad. That's how he knows so much. Well, you know, you heard the intro. You've heard the intro to this podcast. I'm not going to
confirm or deny that.
Yeah, you're not. Yeah. You're not.
That's the Mossad. Anyways, thank you guys.
Thank you guys.
For supporting us, everybody in the live chat. Be best and see you guys.
Yeah. And if you're a patron, then on the night of May 31st, we have our monthly end of month Q&A. That's always a fun thing. It's open to all, so please, you know, come in, bring your friends, bring a drink, and ask us questions on YouTube or Facebook. And it's always a blast. It's always a lot of fun. So,
all right. Be best, everyone.
Take care. Be best. Bye.
The Secular Jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadist.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.